Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host and my co-host, Delilah Jones, president of Imagine Publicity. And on tonight's show, we bring you none other than the incomparable Miss Diane Fanning. And so now, in just a short minute, I want to bring in our guest this evening, but I want to say good evening, Delilah. Thanks for being with me. How's everything in South Carolina?
Everything's doing great down here, Donna. It's
very good.
Chilly, but it's kind of nice, and I'm enjoying it.
Well, that's good, and I'm looking forward to that weather, too. But it's not quite here. It hasn't caught up in Connecticut. And I know Miss Fanning, well, way back when, she used to be in the cold weather because initially she was from Baltimore, Maryland, but now she's in the great state of Texas. So Diane really needs no long formal introduction, at least in our arena. She is a prolific writer. In fact, one of the things we want to focus on today on our show is that she is on the verge of her 20th book. And although she's a true crime author, she also does other genres, and she is also a crusader for crime victims, and it has won a very prestigious award from the Innocence Project in the Chicago area. And in fact, I could go on about her accolades, but we'll let her tell you some more of that story. So it's an honor and a privilege to have Diane on. Thank you, Diane, and welcome to Shattered Life.
Thank you, Donna. Nice to be here with you.
Well, great. It is very pleasurable to have you because we don't often have authors. And I think because you have such a varied scope in terms of what you do as a writer and the myriad of books that you've done, I think whatever books we choose will be very intriguing. And I kind of let you have the pick of any of those that you wanted to do this evening. And so first of all, I want to say congratulations on doing your 20th book. I think it's a wonderful milestone. What do you have to say in retrospect now that you're on the verge of number 20?
I don't know how I got here. I can remember sitting there holding one book in my hand going, finally, a book with my name on the cover. And, you know, it seemed like a miracle then. And it seems like even a bigger miracle now that my 20th book's about to come out.
That is tremendous. It really
what
is.
What inspired you to start writing in the first place, Diane? I know, you know, your background, you did do some writing, but what brought you into true crime and crime novels?
Well, I think it probably started when I really fell in love with the writings of Edgar Allan Poe. And part of that was because I was looking at the dark side a lot. When I was 9 years old, someone had pulled his car up when I was out walking with a little friend, and he asked if we wanted to give him directions, and we tried, and then he asked me to come over and look at his map. Well, I walked over to his open car door, and instead of a map, he was exposing himself. And he grabbed hold of my arm and tried to jerk me into his vehicle. I was very lucky, because at that point in time, another vehicle came over the hill and laid on his horn. He let go of me and took off. But as a devout watcher of Dragnet as a kid, I knew what I had to do was memorize that license plate, and so I did. When I told my mother the man was arrested, when they picked him up, they discovered in the trunk of his car, evidence linking him to the sexual assault and murder of an 8-year-old the month before.
Wow.
So I was supposed to be his next victim. And from then on, I had an interest in why. Why me? Why was I chosen to be a victim? Why would he want to do something like that? And I wanted to understand that. And I started doing a lot of reading about criminal psychology and trying to understand criminal minds. And, you know, that the fascination with Edgar Allan Poe and the Telltale Heart was absolutely total for me for a while. And you know, I went from there to just sort of having it as that psychology component, looking at that as a hobby for most of my life. Then when I heard the story of little Crystal Searles and how this little 10-year-old girl brought a 2-decade reign of murder to an end when she was able to lay there in her hospital bed where her throat had just been cut open. She'd been left for dead. And she couldn't speak, but they brought in a sketch artist. And without speaking, she was able to describe the man so well that they found him immediately and arrested him. And all the people that died in the 2 decades he'd been killing, she found justice for them all. And that made her my hero. And so I had to write her story. There was no way I couldn't write her story. She did something like what I did, but much bigger. You know, she did so much more. And so I really admired her. And I just had to write her story. And that's how I got started writing True Crime Book.
Well, that sounds like it was one of your aha moments. And, you know, this is... You know, did you know, maybe fast-forwarding when you were associated with the Downstate Illinois Innocence Project and Julie Rhea, I mean, and helping to save her, that was another aha moment. Is that where you might have said, oh, damn, I'm good, and this is the profession for me, and this is what I need to do, like, versus being, you were a chemistry major, correct?
Yes, yes. I always had a fascination with writing, though, and always enjoyed it, even as a kid. So it was sort of like something I did on the side, and I'd
right.
done a few, I had a few essays published in prominent magazines and newspapers, and I also did some pieces for smaller magazines, and so I'd been doing writing, but I hadn't really devoted myself to it. But then when I got my first true crime book, I'd gotten a 2-book contract, and it was that first book I wrote, though, that was the one that in which I wrote about Tommy Lynn Sells' confession to the murder of Joel Kirkpatrick. And Joel's mother, Julie Ray, was sitting in prison for killing her son, and she didn't do it. Tommy Lynn Sells killed that boy. And being able to reveal that when the police and the prosecutor were determined not to let anybody speculate any further, and then to see Julie finally get a new trial, be acquitted, and after going through the lengthy process that's required, she received a certificate of actual innocence from the state of Illinois. Not only did that cleanse her record, but it made a clear statement that she never should have had a record.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I got the award from the Downstate Illinois Innocence Project.
Well, I just can't imagine a higher, you know, a more esteemed honor and to know that you were instrumental in that. And I'm just curious about your relationship with her now. Are you very close as friends? And have you carried on since then?
We're very good friends, and we live quite far apart, but we've been together a few times and look forward to getting together again in the future. I love her dearly and respect her immensely, and she's just a wonderful person, and I am so glad that I could help her in some way. If they had, instead of persecuting Julie, gone looking for the man that some people had seen in town and were able to describe, if they had done that, they may have stopped him from killing more people. But because they are wrongfully arrested the mother of that little boy, Tommy Lynn Sells was able to prey on other people and create even more victims.
How long was Julie actually in prison before she was acquitted?
She got out of bail at one point, but I think she was behind bars for 2 years.
Yeah, and that's a long time out of a person's life, and I think she is such an inspiration because she has gone on to do wonderful things, and maybe you can just quickly touch on a few. I mean, it's you wonder what person actually would do to a human being, and for some reason, Julie has made her life really, really count.
Yes, she has, and she's dealing with the trauma of the event. Just if you're a mother, losing your child for any reason is just the most horrific thing that ever can happen to another woman. And on top of that, to lose your child to violence makes it even worse. And then to be falsely accused of being the one responsible, right, and having a jury say, yeah, you did it, go to jail. Then when you get into the jail environment, well, she was in a jail environment and then prison. But in those environments, if you're someone who has led a life that is, crime-free, and that you've been someone who's not been exposed to a criminal element, it is a harsh awakening to find yourself in that environment. And Julie found herself there being physically abused by some of the others, and she has a traumatic brain injury from it, and it's so she has some strikes against her, but she's studying now for the LSAT, and she wants to go to law school. She's done some work as a mitigation specialist, and I wish her all the luck, and I think she would be a truly incredible, compassionate attorney, and I hope that she succeeds at that.
Wow, that's tremendous. It really is, and I just think it's an awe-inspiring story, and I hope that you can say that, you never tire of telling about it, because although those of us who know you think that everyone knows that story, I'm sure there are a lot of people out there that do not. So I'm glad we're really able to touch on that. And would you like to kind of segue into one of the books that we were going to focus on, Diane?
Well, since we're right at this moment talking about wrongful conviction, it would be appropriate to go to the fiction book.
Okay.
The problem with wrongful conviction is twofold, and I touched on that briefly, and that is not only does a wrongful conviction harm the innocent person and devastate that person's family, but it also has the other effect of allowing a perpetrator to think he got away with it, to continue to roam the streets preying on other victims.
Right, right.
Yeah, and being more confident of his ability to do so because he got away with it and someone else is sitting behind bars. And the average person that would commit a murder like that is like the kind of person that doesn't care. He didn't care that someone else was behind jail for a crime he committed. In fact, mm-hmm. he said, she's not the only one. So
the arrogance of criminals, you know, isn't it amazing?
Yeah. And so, because I thought this was such an incredibly important issue, I put it within my book, Wrong Turn. I turned it over to my protagonist, Lieutenant Lucinda Pierce. And what happened with her is that there were two cases that she was looking at. One of them was that she wasn't even officially in homicide yet, and she was working with a older homicide cop to assist him in a case where a stepmother was convicted for killing her daughter, her stepdaughter. And everybody thought that woman was guilty. No one believed that there was any reason to let her out, hardly. And suddenly, in a house where basements were buried in a body, they found the body of this deceased girl. And they realized then that this could not be something the stepmother did. She had to be the victim of a serial killer. And Lucinda comes up against the wall of politics in the criminal justice system. And unfortunately, there are many prosecutors who will not admit they're wrong, even in the face of the most striking evidence. And they will not come out and say it. And even if they realize they made a mistake, they tried to delay the process of getting the person out of jail, which I just don't understand that. Because a prosecutor's mission is supposed to be to seek truth and find justice. And you'll find language to that effect in almost every state constitution in the United States. That is what they're supposed to do. And a lot of prosecutors are that way. They know their mission and they live their mission. But there are others who have completely lost sight of their mission, and all they think about is their win-lose record, and they want to win. And because they're so stubborn about that, they do not want to admit that they may have committed an injustice in the prosecution of someone. Then you have other state officials who go, oh, gosh, if we admit that she should be out of jail, then maybe we're going to have to pay a whole bunch of money to this person for keeping her incarcerated, you know, falsely. And so it gets so politically complicated.
If there's an incorrect prosecution, doesn't that taint other prosecutions from that particular attorney, and they have to go back and look at other cases? Or am I going too much into the law and order genre?
it depends on why the conviction was overturned.
Okay.
There are certain things that would be considered acceptable, you know, like they're just certain technicalities. Sometimes the judge lets you put a piece of evidence in, and then the appeals court says that was inappropriate. Well, you know, that isn't really an error by the prosecution. It's more of maybe he shouldn't have asked, but the judge shouldn't have let him do it. So, you know, those kinds of things aren't damaging to a career. But when you've got a case that you have an attorney, for example, that stands up and says, well, we recovered no stranger fingerprints in the home, and then you find out way down the road that's because no one dusted for fingerprints, well, you've got a situation where it's either law enforcement or prosecution that is at fault there. And, you know, there's things like that where evidence is hidden from the defense and information is hidden that often prosecutors get away with, and I don't think they should. Mm-hmm. I think they should be called to task for that, but it often doesn't happen.
Oh, I agree. I think they get away with a lot. They really do. And so Lucinda, from what I've read, she seems very, very tormented with regard to past decisions that she's made, you know, because there's several miscarriages of justice here, aren't there? You mentioned vandalism, and then there's the murder of a politician's wife, and then there's the serial killer. So it seems to be from one end of the continuum on. I mean, you know, how vandalism up to a serial killer there, you cover it all.
Well, with the vandalism thing, that is connected to Charlie Spencer, who is Lucinda's friend. Charlie's like 10 years old, and she's 12 years old. And her mother had been a murder victim in the very first book, and that's where Lucinda meets Charlie and sort of becomes a mentor to Charlie after Charlie loses her mother. And so that she gets falsely accused of vandalism, and they caught her at the scene of the crime, but the problem was that she just came in her silly little childlike way to investigate the crime and happened to be caught there when someone called in knowing she would be caught there. So there was that to deal with. And then there was the politician who had killed a couple of wives, actually, had been convicted of one of them. And he was claiming that he was not guilty, he was innocent. He actually got his trial overturned on a technicality. And so Lucinda has a lot of self-doubt. She's got to re-look at this case again. And she doesn't know, did I make a mistake here too? Was I involved in something? Because this was all her case. So she knew if it went wrong, she was the one that was totally responsible. And so she has to look at that case and understand it. And along the way, she finds another victim, not one of the wives, but the child of the first woman that the politician had killed. And that little boy had been keeping information he had inside of himself, and he was now in his middle teen years, and it was causing him all sorts of problems because he wasn't letting go of the truth and facing up to the reality of what happened. And because of what Lucinda did, the truth came out. And yes, the man was guilty and he did go back to prison. There's all different ways that wrongful accusations and wrongful convictions can turn out. Sometimes justice is done, and the person who is innocent is set free, and the person who is guilty is put back behind bars. But unfortunately, that's not always the case. Sometimes the innocent remain in prison, and the guilty are let free. But I just hope that when the guilty are let free, that some sort of karma is going to catch up with them, like it did with O.J. Simpson, you know?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Do you think as an author, when you're writing these books, does it make for a better book when you kind of tie all the things together toward the end, or do you think it's better in some way in terms of leaving the reader hanging? There's something you're not saying to them, or do you like to tie up all the loose ends so that readers know?
Well, you try to tie up all the loose ends. I mean, just like there are things that might be left, but they're not significant parts of the plot. You know, the significant parts of the plot, you've got to give satisfaction, but one of the subplots is there is a little romantic tension between Lieutenant Pierce and an FBI agent, and they like each other, but she is reluctant to commit to a relationship, and because of a lot of what happened in her past. And so you never know if they're going to be on again or off again. So that's sort of always left open. And that's continued through, well, he came in the second book in the series, and it's continued up to this point. And I am working on the seventh book, which doesn't have a title yet, but we're working on that.
It's really an exciting series of books, and there's nothing I love better than to be able to start with one and continue on. I just, you know, when you read a book and you come to the end and it's the end and you want more, and to read a series like that is always real satisfying.
Well, and I try to, with this series, I've tried with, you know, in every book to touch on something that matters, some important issue. Like in one of them, it was teen suicide, and another one, it was, you know, mental health and bad parenting. And, you know, I tried to have something that matters.
Right. In this book, are you trying to say that even very good investigators, they make mistakes, and, you know, therefore, you know, they are not infallible? I mean, is that one of the messages?
Well, yeah, I mean, it is. They do make mistakes. Very, very good detectives can make mistakes.
Right.
But what distinguishes a good detective and a great detective is the fact that a great detective is willing to look at the possibility that they made a mistake and do what they can to rectify that mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Lucinda does. And you've seen them in some of the stories of cops that send somebody to jail, and when they found out they sent the wrong person to jail, they move heaven and earth to get that person out. So, you know, there are a lot of good cops out there, and basically it would be nice if all of them were that way.
Right, and it kind of lends itself to what you were saying earlier, just the opposite with regard to the prosecutors. They won't admit when they've made a mistake and go back, so it doesn't make them, you know, a good prosecutor. Just makes
well,
them,
you
know,
there's a prosecutor in Dallas County
who,
when he took over the office, the first thing he did was copy the Constitution about seeking truth and finding justice, and put it up by each one of the prosecutor's desks. And he also has gotten into a collaborative effort with the Innocence Project of Texas. And what they do is they review cases where there are claims of innocence and look into ones that can be easily righted or easily proven. Mostly they've been doing like DNA cases, you know, so that if there's DNA that has never been tested, they're working together to get that tested and get the innocent out of jail and shut the door for good on the people who are guilty.
Wow, that's impressive.
There ought to be more prosecutors doing things like that.
Of course. Well, maybe you should write a book about him.
Yeah.
How do you decide which cases, whether it be, well, I know in your fiction series you can kind of tie in ideas from a lot of different cases, but in your
and
true
I can
crime,
kill whoever I want to.
Yeah.
That's,
oh my God! And nobody gets hurt. It's only with the power
right.
of the pen and the typewriter, or the computer.
Yeah. But how do you decide what cases you're going to write about? Because I mean, you've written you're into your 20th book, and you've written about such a variety of cases, and, you know, from Kaylee Anthony to Michael Peterson to, you know, the one that we'll be discussing here in a little bit, the death of Michael Severance. But when they come to you, are you suggested cases? How does that
sometimes
work?
Sometimes they're suggested by a publisher. Sometimes, like in the case of the Michael Severance case, that was suggested to me by a detective. What I look for is something that kind of catches my attention right off. Unfortunately, there are so many murders that happen that some of them just seem to, you know, they don't have anything that says to me, this is interesting.
Yeah.
Well, this is interesting. What can I learn from this? You know, and I figure if there's something I can learn, then that means there's something I can share with my readers. So that's what I always look for, is something like that. And, you know, the first book, it was Crystal Searles, who was a 10-year-old victim. In the second book, it was a girl named Kara, who was 15 and actually was responsible for ending a serial killer's murders. But then each one goes to another, like the one I have coming out on April 30th. The issue with something that is very unusual. There are a lot of people, and it seems like we hear it all the time now, there are a lot of mothers who kill their children. But most of that happens with little children. The younger they are, the more common that is. But rarely does a mother ever kill teenage children. If teenage children are killed by a parent, it is usually the father. But when I read about Julie Schenecker, and she shot her two teenage kids, I was wanting to know more. Why did this woman, 50 years old, respectable member of her community, someone who had never committed a crime before, a woman who had once been in the Army as a Russian intelligence expert, why would she do something like that? And I wanted to know why. So that's what made me want to look into that case and write a book about it.
Diane, have you ever researched, looked into it, and I'm sorry that I don't know this, but if you have, you can inform me, any woman who has gone through Munchausen syndrome and written a book regarding that, you know, where they just have this mental health issue with respect to constantly saying as if their children, their relative is sick and looking for attention, and invariably some have led to killing their children because of that need for attention.
I have not done a case like that. But it is pretty fascinating, and trying to understand that drive would be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be something I'll do in the future, because I would like to understand it. You know, and I think, you know, the two important things that people can learn from a true crime book is ways not to become a victim. And when I talk to high school students, that's one of the big lessons that I'm always telling them. And I have stories from my books of the mistakes some people have made in their lives that weren't really that significant a mistake, like one girl who went somewhere without telling and lied to her mother about where she was going. You know, things like that can put you in a place where you're vulnerable. And those teenagers need to understand that. And a lot of times, since, you know, I've talked to killers and I've written extensively about crime, they'll listen to me about things and take it more seriously than they would from a teacher or a parent. So I talk to them about how not to become a victim. The other thing is to know what the red flags look like, so that if you're in a bad relationship, you know what the flags are for that, and to get out of it before you're too far in. If you see something going on with a neighbor, a family member, or a friend, you need to be able to identify what's a danger signal and what is just someone's simple eccentricity. And that is the way we can not only protect ourselves, but we can protect others. And those are the things that that draw a lot of people to reading true crime books. They want to know more, and they want to see some of these crimes prevented.
Right. Diane, don't you think there's a big difference or an obstacle in, okay, it's one thing to say that, okay, I know that there's domestic violence going on next door because I can hear the beating or whatnot, but then for that person to actually make a conscious decision to become involved and do something proactive.
Yeah, it's very difficult. Because, you know, we have this urge to mind our own business. We
right.
have this doubt about what our instincts and our gut feelings are telling us.
Mm-hmm.
And, yes, things sometimes seem like they're not. But at the very least, having a conversation with a person you think is being victimized
mm-hmm.
or reporting suspicious behavior about somebody that seems to be doing something that isn't right is a lot better way to go than to just, you know, close your eyes and say, you know, I don't see anything. I'm not going to look at anything.
Mm-hmm.
You can make an impact on other people's lives. And plus, with some people, an intervention can actually keep them from going through with a crime. But there are other cases where just knowing things can help you extricate yourself from a situation. Like one thing that that has popped up in many, many crimes has been the fact that the perpetrator is keeping secrets. Like with Michael Peterson, he had stuff at his office that people knew they weren't supposed to go in there, and he was hiding his secrets that way. Mark Ivanek, serial killer, excuse me, he had a foot locker filled with newspaper clippings and girls' underwear, and his wives both knew. Well, he had one at a time, but they both knew that they were not allowed to touch that locker. Now, that is a red flag. If you were in a relationship, an intimate relationship, and there are places that are off limits, then that's a reason for concern, and that is a reason to maybe get away or at least look into it and find out what the heck is going on.
Right.
Nate, now, with Mark Ivanek, neither one of his wives died, but he was out there killing young girls. And had they
investigated
up and recognized it, you know, maybe lives would have been saved.
Right. Well, you know, that's kind of a familiar refrain. I remember Denny Griffin saying that on one of the shows, too, with regard to had the police done this or done that, then and caught this person or been more proactive, then, you know, victims 2, 3, 4, and 5 would never have happened. So it's the same thing in terms of, you know, the police actions or, you know, being able to catch the perpetrator before more crime is committed.
Yes, yes. And that is of such inestimable importance. People will never know. And none of us will ever know how many lives little Crystal Searles saved when she was able to bring Tommy Lynn Sells to justice.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows who else he would have killed? At the weekend that he was caught, he was planning, before he left town, to go kill an attorney who was a public defender. He was going to kill her because he'd been hanging out at her house, drinking and doing drugs with her son. She didn't know about the drugs, but they were there. And at one point, she asked him to please get off the phone. She had to make an important call, and that's why he decided he was going to kill her.
Ultimately, he confessed to that, another murder that he was planning?
Yes, he admitted that he was planning on killing her that night.
How many murders do we know about that Tommy?
He's confessed to about 50. He said he was only 70% done. They have been able to confirm 20 of them. There are some they will never be able to confirm because he didn't know their names. Their bodies were left in places that now it's as much as 30 years ago, and
mm-hmm.
they probably may never be found.
Right.
And, you know, so there's no way to be able to prove it. I mean, when someone says, I got into a fight with a black man in Detroit and I killed him and dumped his body in a dumpster, when that happened in the 80s, how are you ever going to find that? You're not.
It's
that
true.
Crime will
it's so
never
generic.
Be solved.
Yeah, that's true. Wow.
He definitely made it a career, so, you know, there's probably hundreds and hundreds of people whose lives were saved by the acts of one small child.
Yes, yes. Isn't that incredible?
It really is.
The perseverance and courage of that little girl is just astounding.
Mm-hmm. Wow, it really touches my heart. And it's true. What about... Some of the issues with regard to A Poison Passion, and that book really has to do with someone who goes missing. And I know that you as well as I, having attended the Q Center for the Missing Conference last year, we were really inspired by our attendance there in so many ways. And I just wonder how interacting with people at that conference may have made an impression with regard to, you know, books on the topic.
Well, you know, one thing one piece of knowledge I gained while working on A Poison Passion was
mm-hmm.
talking to Michael Severance's parents about their experience and how it was to have Michael missing and not having any idea of where he was. And it is just one of the most traumatic experiences that you can imagine, because there is so much anxiety and
mm-hmm.
so much hope. And the wings of hope can be very fragile, and they can be torn off so fast when a body is then found. And you know, going to the Q Center conference, I met all of these people who were keeping this hope alive in their heart. Some of them, their loved ones have been missing for years, and they had no idea where they are.
Mm-hmm.
One woman I talked to there extensively and had a lot of time with her, it just was astonishing to me that the day the conference was over, her nephew's body was found.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just to hear all her hopes and her wants for the future, for him to be found and helped wherever he was, and then to find out that, you know, her hope had just been crushed.
Right.
It really affected me very deeply. And there's so many more just out there hoping, and others with stories of encouragement. And, you know, from time to time, they're like these miracle stories of abductions, like the young girl out in Utah, where after being gone for so long and just about everybody assuming she's dead, there she comes. You know, so you just never know. You never know, and that is something that eats away at the family members and friends, and it just erodes their hearts. Just the not knowing is a horrible, horrible ordeal.
Right, it just eats at you, it would seem. And the wife, Wendy, there, she blamed the dying grandmother, correct?
What she did at first was just when she took his body after she killed him, she took his body out to a stock pond and tied some automobile parts and concrete blocks and stuffed him in, on his body and threw him in. Then, like a lot of criminals, she did not
Sounds like Scott
really,
Peterson trial, really.
A lot of criminals, she did not plan ahead enough and didn't think of all the possibilities before she committed the crime. So afterwards, she goes and looks up on the internet and realizes that, oh, darn, he probably is going to float to the surface. So what does she do? She goes back out there. After talking to his parents and knowing how upset they were, not knowing what happened to him, she fishes his body out. She ties more weights to it. She takes her knife and stabs holes in the body so that the gases will escape, and then dumps him back in the water.
Yeah.
I mean, that is so
times?
Horrible.
Yeah. Oh,
yes.
I can't imagine. I can't imagine. That only
and this woman was a veterinarian.
And a stupid criminal.
A veterinarian.
Too. She didn't do much research. She was a stupid criminal. Oh, God.
Well,
but,
they
usually
are. They all make a mistake. And sometimes good police work can uncover that. And sometimes just determined detectives can have a piece of dumb luck and find what they need for a prosecution. And it's... But you know what? People say, oh, well, the only reason they caught that person is because it was dumb luck. Well, yeah, it was dumb luck. But if those detectives had not been determined and kept pushing that case, they would have never stumbled across that piece of dumb luck. So it was their hard work and their dedication to finding justice for this victim that finally did resolve it, even if there was a little dumb luck involved.
But wasn't there drugs that a veterinarian would use normally on animals, and would that somehow show up in toxicology versus drugs that you would see that people consume?
Well, what she used is the drug that was used to put dogs to sleep. Now, because the body had been underwater for so long, the toxicology stuff would not be all that reliable, particularly, you know, the state the body was in at that time. But what they were able to prove is they went through her records. And a veterinarian, when they use lethal substances like that or any other controlled drug, they have to keep a log of exactly what medication they used and how much of it they used. And what she did was she went back in her logs and doctored it so that over numerous animals, she was able to add a certain amount of that drug to reach a bottom total that gave her enough left over to administer and kill her husband.
So the dregs of, you know, this euthanized animal, she collected enough so that it would affect her husband. Oh,
yep.
My goodness.
Yeah.
And can you share with our audience what your feeling is with regard to motivation? I mean, he had a wonderful career, you know, in the Air Force and, you know, appeared to love it, a family man. I just don't get it.
Yes, Michael was a C-130 crew chief, had a fabulous career, and also he was the kind of guy that you just can't help liking. I mean, he was, and it wasn't just charisma, he was, he had a big heart. He was always willing to help people. He had a wonderful sense of humor. He was a very good, decent young man that you would think anyone would welcome into their family with open arms.
Sure.
But the problem was, in this family, one thing they held against him was the fact that he was from Maine.
Okay.
And the other thing they had, well, you know, I mean, some people just don't like you Yankees. But
hey, we're very lovable.
But he was a decent guy. I mean, when he picked up Wendy at a bar and took her home and got her pregnant, he said, okay, we'll get married. I'll take responsibility for that child. He had lost his mother to an illness when he was a young teenager, and he knew what it was like to grow up without two parents. Mm-hmm. And he was determined that his child was not going to have that experience. So he was going to marry the woman who was carrying his child.
Mm-hmm. Well, did he love her, or was it just the right thing to do?
I think it was the right thing to do. He was, you know, doing the right thing to do. I think that he had positive feelings towards her, mm-hmm. and I think he was hoping that they could build a relationship based on love. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there was a mutual attraction, and quite frankly, there are a lot of marriages founded on nothing, no firmer foundation than that. And
right.
his, he just felt that he had to do the right thing. I mean, that's the way he was raised, to do the right thing. And so he was willing to do it.
Why did she despise him?
You would think she would have been grateful. You would think that her parents would have been grateful that their grandchild wasn't going to be born out of wedlock like the last one was, without a father anywhere. But not only did Michael take responsibility for that new baby, but her other child, who was 3 years old, he treated that child like he was his own, and he planned on adopting that child. So, you know, this was, he was an upright man. He was a good man, and but her parents did not like him from the beginning. He was a Yankee. He was not from around here. He was also he was a man, and therefore not good enough for their daughter. No one would ever be good enough for their daughter. And so what happened was this slow poison. Every single day, her mother told Wendy how much she hated Michael, how much she couldn't stand him, how much she wanted him gone, day after day after day after day. Mm-hmm. And then when the plans were... And then when the plans were for Wendy to go with both of the boys and her new husband, Michael, and visit Michael's family in Maine, her mother planted the idea and kept reinforcing it, that if you go there, either he won't let you come back or the kids, or you'll come back without the kids. Mm-hmm. We, you know, we'll never see our grandchildren again because he's not going to let them come back. Mm-hmm. And so in addition to this slow drop of poison against her husband, her mother was feeding her this information that, you know, she had something to fear by this trip mm-hmm. to Maine. And so it was the night before they were supposed to go to Maine that she killed him.
Mm.
Oh, yeah. I forgot. Was the mom an accomplice?
Well, no, she didn't. She didn't help with it. Well, if you talk to the mother's stepfather, he thinks that she had something to do with it. But as far as the official version of events is that also, although she committed, she, on an emotional level, she created an environment which made this possible, mm-hmm. she did not have anything to do with the crime itself.
I see. Delilah, I'm sorry, I interrupted.
No, I'm just in the way that they found his body weighted down with all. How did she do this all by herself? Did she not have any other accomplice that helped her load it up or tie everything?
Well, you got to remember that she is a veterinarian. And that she had no trouble picking up large animals and caring for them. I mean, she was strong. And she also was determined. And she had a pickup truck that, you know, she could back right up to the back door and drag his body up on the bed of the truck. When they got there to the stock pond, she could pull his body out of the truck onto the dock, and she put him in this boat that they keep out there and tied all this stuff to him and put him in. You know, it was definitely strenuous activity, but it was
calculated
something she was capable.
Yeah. Wow.
And it's just so horrible to me, because to me, Michael, who knows what he would have done, you know, with his life. I mean, he's such a good guy. And forever, his father and stepmother, they will miss him for the rest of their lives.
Definitely.
You know, his stepsisters and his brother will miss him for the rest of their lives.
Certainly. And, you know, I think we all have to, as a word of caution, you know, it all starts with an interaction with somebody, and it becomes intimate, and then whoops, and then it kind of snowballs and the domino effect, and look, this wonderful guy gets killed. The watchword is, you know, just be careful who you hook up with. You don't know who these people are, really.
But, you know, on the surface, here is a woman who not only did she go to veterinary school, she was one of the few who were able to get into veterinary school after just 2 years of college and get her degree at the same time, have a child while she's still in veterinary school. And then she owns her own business. I mean, she, on the surface, looked pretty darn good.
I'm sure she did. You know, it sounds like, it's a fascinating book. And, Diane, I have to tell you, we have about 3 minutes left to the show, unfortunately. It's just flying by. We'll have to have you back sometime in the near future. But in that time, I want to make sure that you can tell people where to get your books, whether it's the first one or the 20th one or any of them in between. And do you have as an author, do you derive the most satisfaction from, like, the research or the writing or maybe, you know, the talking to people, interviewing them, or is it just in the educating others about crime that you alluded to? Just wondering those things.
It's a balance between all of those things, Donna. And that's one thing I like. Writing is solitary. But all the other things gives me interaction with people, and basically I like people. So to have both, and the research appeals to my nerdy side. So all of it together keeps me a multifaceted person.
Yeah. Do you like Yankees?
Sure enough.
Not the Yankees.
I was born in a border state with northern family and southern family. The southerners a little Yankee, and the Northerners called me a little rebel. So, you know,
I see. Well,
I'm a divided child.
I hope I don't have to hire protection now. You're making me nervous. But anyway, can you please tell us your contact information and where people can get your books, and tell us about your latest book signing in the last couple of minutes?
Diane at DianeFanning.com is my email. My website is www.DianeFanning.com. You'll find links on my website to my Twitter and my Rebel Mouse and my Facebook, and, you know, all that kind of stuff is right there. And I'm going to have a number of book signings going on in May and June. I'm going to be next month. I'm going to be at the Book and Author Luncheon for the Friends of the Burney Library, which will be really, really nice. I'll be speaking there and signing books. And in the meanwhile, I'm working on books. I've got contracts for two books ahead, working on the seventh book in the Lucinda Pierce series, and I'm also working on a true crime book out of Virginia about an assistant principal at a high school who murdered his wife.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that sounds fascinating. You're going to have to tell me more about that off here. Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to sign off, though. And I say, please, everyone, do tune in next week. I wanted to let you know this is a one-year benchmark or milestone for Shattered Lives. So I want to say thank you, Delilah, for putting up with me for almost 52 weeks last year. We're going strong. Diane, thank you so much. I'll talk to you out there. Looking for a fantastic blog tonight so we can brag about Diane some more. And we'll see you next week, everyone. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Donna. Congratulations.
Okay.